everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy Tom Fairbanks. Tom, as advertised, as predicted, there was a light layer of ice on the Buckmaster Hacienda bird bath. And I was a bit surprised. I was thinking, you know, maybe 33, because I did not cover some of the sensitive vegetation, but let's hope it was a very short freeze.
So did you still have your ice skate rentals out for the birds, or had you already put them away for the season?
They were already put away for the season. The birds are going like, what is going on? And a lot of people are asking that in Tucson, Arizona. My goodness, the coldest morning here since 1945. Welcome to the Buckmaster program. We do it here Monday through Friday, 12:04 to 1. Today, Wednesday, April the 5th, 2023. The show in our 13th year, broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. We come to you on KVOI, Tucson's Voice. It's 10:30. On the dial, our worldwide live listening, buckmastershow.com. Our live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Why don't we utilize the live line to get things rolling and go to the Ward 6 Tucson City Council offices of Democrat Steve Kasachek. Councilman, how are you today?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing, Bill?
Doing well. Yeah, it's very strange weather, and it's been a very, very chilly winter, but 90 degrees is right around the corner.
Oh, yuck. I would much prefer the chill. Two mornings ago, I was out running with two T-shirts, and this morning it was five T-shirts. So, it's like a roller coaster, but I am not looking forward to the 100-plus degree heats that we have in front of us, so I'm kind of enjoying this right now.
Yeah, it is coming. All right. I didn't hear the news from the council meeting, so perhaps you can fill us in. And I know one of the marquee issues was the extension, or would there be an extension, of free rides on SunTrend. Steve Kasachek, what happened?
Yeah, so yesterday we had the item on the agenda. There are several moving pieces to that. One is trying to get other users, other participants in the system to step up to the plate and help fund the roughly $10 million shortfall if we don't do the fares. The players in that include the university, the Pima College, TUSD, some major employers. Our staff did a survey, and surveyed the ridership around bus stops around those major institutions and some of the major employers, and found that there are several hundred thousand people who are getting on the bus and off the bus around those groups. Which means that if we are going to provide that service and they are significant beneficiaries of it, we would like to have them step up to the plate and help fund the system. We've gotten some receptivity. TUSD seems to be absolutely willing to play a part. We're talking productively with Pima College, the university not so much so far, but we hope that that's going to change. As of yesterday, we decided to continue that outreach. Have staff continue to do the door knocks on the with some of these major users. As I say, it's about a $10 million hit to the general fund if we do not, if we do not resume the fares. You know, we haven't charged bus fares since COVID started, and it's very difficult to take away a benefit that people have had and say, okay, you know, back to square one. I don't think that there is any appetite on the council to go back to where we were. I think everybody on the council, myself included, is sensitive to the fact that lots of people are still hurting in a tough economy right now. I've said all along, though, that there are people who can afford to pay to support the system. And yet every time I run or walk or bike past a bus shelter, I've never seen anybody standing outside in a business suit waiting for the bus. So clearly the majority of our riders need some assistance. Should the U of A do more? Absolutely. You know, should major employers? Of course. Should the RTA, whose funding support is just sunsetted this year, they should be a part of this as well. I think it's time that we make a decision. I was actually ready to yesterday. The rest of the council wanted to delay this a bit longer and continue the outreach. My perspective is that we give people an opportunity to support the system, but I wanted to pivot the conversation, and that is to say, look, if we're not going to simply put the fare boxes back in place, let's put something on the buses that will, in a similar way, help our general fund, because the bus fare support is coming out of the general fund anyway. My idea is that we have downtown and scattered around town these parking meters that people feed to help support our homeless work program. My idea is let's put those meters as in the form of a collection box on each of the buses, mm-hmm. make it voluntary. If people want to support the homeless work program, get on the bus and drop a one or drop a five, drop a quarter into that, and it'll go directly to helping homeless people find jobs and work under the city's tutelage. If you don't have it or if you don't want to, then fine. We'd keep the fare free for people who want to ride. But my sense is that we're going to get a lot of people who will get on the bus and want to help homeless people work and drop some money in. Probably get more that way than we're getting through the parking meters. But as far as the fares themselves are concerned, my expectation is that that the council at some point is just going to rip the bandage off and say we're not going to do fares anymore. But we do want the major institutions that I mentioned to join us in helping to fund the system. I mean, it's students. Students constitute roughly 70% of the streetcar ridership. I mean, why wouldn't U of A students? I mean, why wouldn't the U of A play a role in helping to support that system? And so there's that conversation that's happening. But I think at some point we're just going to say, we've gone this far, free fares. We want the help from these other institutions. And oh, by the way, if you want to help homeless people in our homeless work program, we're going to make a voluntary contribution ask as you get on the bus and see where that goes.
I think that is a great idea. A give if you can. Box there as you enter onto the bus. Good idea, Steve Kasachek.
Hopefully it works.
All right. Title 42 may be going away. Front page story in the Star. This will not help. It is a difficult situation. People have stepped up. I know that in our community, but we're going to need more to step up and more resources, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Title 42 needs to go away. Let's call it what it is. Title 42 was pandemic related. It was supposed to address the healthcare situation that we've all been living through for the last 3 years. It is not an immigration policy. It's a medical, it's a healthcare policy that really doesn't need to be in place and shouldn't be in place any longer. But to your point, yeah, you're absolutely correct. I mean, once Title 42 goes away, the number of migrants that we're seeing crossing the border could skyrocket. We are still seeing 300 to 500 people per day at the Alitas Welcome Center, the county-run facility that Catholic Community Services is managing. That's 300 to 500 a day. That number could triple overnight. One of the real challenges that we have with managing that place, though, is that we could get a phone call, they could get a phone call and say, we're going to be dropping off a busload of people in 45 minutes. That call could come in the middle of the night. Mm. It is largely driven by volunteers. And so for them to scramble and find volunteers to come out and do the intake, which involves a medical check, a COVID check, getting people food, getting people clothes, making contact with next of kin, making sure that they've got the documentation through Border Patrol when they arrive. All of that just doesn't happen. You know, people, the volunteers who are running that, running the system, running the shelter, along with the Catholic Community Services staff, are responsible for that. So what we need from the government are a few different things. Number one, most importantly, is that the county who is operating that facility, they need financial support. It is not the county's responsibility to manage the immigration system. It is the federal government's. And so they need money ahead of time, proactively, before the numbers start to show up at the center, so that if necessary, once we get to capacity there, they can go out and start renting some hotel space for the short term. That's something that the county is coming out of pocket for right now and being paid retroactively, and that doesn't work when you're trying to manage a budget. So that's one thing that we need from the federal government. And the second thing we need from the federal government is an assurance and a real open communication line that the people running the center and all the shelters have more advanced notice than a phone call saying we're on the way and get ready. You know, I mean, even 24 hours notice would be helpful.
Yeah.
But we haven't been getting that since we were doing this at the Greyhound bus station downtown and then at the Benedictine and now at the Alita Center. This is really a scramble when you get the phone call operation. And to their credit, CCS and the county and all the volunteers are doing an excellent job. But it's no way to run a railroad. And the final thing that I would say is that, and this isn't necessarily something from the federal government, but you're right. We're going to continue to need the community to step up to the plate and bring us the creature comforts, the lotions and the hygiene products and the sunscreen and all the kinds of clean underclothes, clean socks that the migrants have been showing up at the center and they're going to simply need. We continue to take donations at the Ward 6 office. We're open 9 to 1 Monday through Friday, 3202 East 1st, and the Alita Center comes by here once a week and picks up all the donations that we take, and it's been going on for a decade now. And,
wow.
And high marks to our community for continuing to stick with it. And to dispel the potential phone call, how come you're harboring a bunch of illegals? People show up at these shelters. They have been vetted by Border Patrol. They have travel documents. They have paper. They have a next of kin. They are here legally pending the adjudication of their asylum their asylum claims. And what we do is we process them through to a sponsor or a next of kin somewhere else in the country. And so they're here for a day or two maximum. And that's the reason they need things that they can get on the bus with and, travel in relative comfort.
All right, Steve. Yeah. All right, Steve Kosacek, you know we want to talk about a place that has become so popular. And Steve, as you know, if you have a good product, if you are offering something that the public wants, people will come. You know that.
Yep, and we love the fact that they continue to go out to Mona's, and they are continuing to support that operation. And I am so glad to see that as one of the local businesses that has struggled through COVID, and they're on their feet now, and
yep.
People are lining up out the door on the weekends.
They are. Get there early. That's my advice. They open at 7 Sunday morning. I'm usually up there pretty early Sunday. People are waiting in line Tuesday through Saturday when they open at 6:30, and they wait Sunday, too. And why not? They want the best selection from the bakery case. Mona's Danish Bakery, northeast corner, Swan and Sunrise, open right now for lunch. Their website's monasdanishbakery.com. Got more with Steve Kosacek right after this.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Bill Buckmaster with you on this midweek edition of Easter Week. We have Steve Kasachek, Tucson City Councilman, Democrat, representing Ward 6, with us on our live line, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. I have noticed several signs on street corners urging people to vote yes. And if folks are wondering, do we have an election? And the answer is yes, we do. And in a couple of weeks, don't we, Steve?
We absolutely do. In fact, the ballots will be going out roughly the 17th of this month, and May 16th is the election day. It is called Proposition 412. It is an extension of the existing Tucson Electric Power franchise agreement. Sort of the Reader's Digest version of it, because that kind of stuff can get really weedy. Every utility has the right has an agreement in place by which they can operate in the public rights of way. TEP's franchise agreement expires in 2026. The reason that they're wanting to go to the ballot now is because a couple of years ago they started putting forward a proposal to go vertical above ground with some massive distribution lines on what is, down Campbell, around the university and down Campbell towards Grant, in what is one of our gateway corridors, so named by ordinance. Also by ordinance is that any new utility going in on a gateway or a scenic corridor has to be undergrounded. TEP didn't feel as though they were going to need to do that. We told them that, in fact, our ordinances are in place for a reason, and we were not going to simply cashier them and vitiate their integrity. And so now incorporated in the franchise agreement is a 0.75% increase in their franchise fee that will be earmarked specifically for undergrounding new utilities. That will yield about $4 or $5 million. There's another 10%. There's 10% of that will go towards climate resiliency programs, such as, you know, more robust solar commitment, that kind of thing. So the converse, there are two sides, of course, to every vote. The people who are on the pro side are saying that we need to have the guaranteed money right now for the underground, and we need, more importantly, to make sure TEP has the right to operate in the rights of way for the next 25 years. The other side is saying, actually, this is a good time to extract more solid commitments from TEP for a more robust response to climate resiliency, things such as wind and solar and getting off of fossil fuels. So it's going to be an interesting conversation. I am hosting at the ward office a public meeting where TEP will be here. They'll make a presentation to demonstrate, you know, to talk about what, you know, what they are looking for in the franchise agreement. The public will have a chance to ask their questions. That will be on Tuesday, the 11th, about a week before the ballots drop. And it'll start at 6 o'clock at night. It'll be both in person and virtually. And TEP, as I say, will be here to answer any questions that people may have about the franchise agreement.
Let me ask you, these franchise agreements, how often do they come up? What if voters said no? I mean, TEP is not going to, you know, pull up stakes and go away.
Yeah, and so that's a really great point. And so the franchise agreement is good for 25 years. Mm. If this were to fail at the ballot box, they would have to come back yet again, likely next year. TEP, by the way, is paying all the costs for the election and for the signs that you see around town. So this is their franchise agreement. They are the ones who are driving the election and paying for the cost of the election. If it came to 2026 and the voters still said no, this has not happened before, but the very likely outcome would be that we would continue with an extension to their existing terms of their agreement and continue to negotiate the terms of one and put it back to the voters. Ultimately, this is not something that the mayor and council can approve. This is something that has to go to the voters. And I suppose if it continued to get rejected at the ballot box, at some point the Corporation Commission would step in and make a call. But that there is no precedent for that at all.
What are you hearing about our tourism season, which typically, January to April or so? Are you getting good feedback? Was it a good season, Steve Kasachuk?
I'm hearing from Visit Tucson that it was a good season, and it still is a good season. It continues, of course. We've got the the snowbirds here for, you know, what, another couple of months.
Yeah.
Revenue per room, the room rates, the occupancy rates, they're all, according to the data that I've been looking at, they're all approximately what they were pre-COVID. And so you know, we talked about Mona's and the businesses that are struggled through COVID. The same is true of the travel industry, the tourism industry. I mean, nobody was traveling during COVID, right? And so we had hotels that were just struggling to stay open. I know that there, for instance, the Arizona Inn, for instance, is still not able to open their dining room. But they are, one of the reasons for that is that they can't find enough staff. Mm-hmm. So their rooms are really booked well, but they're still looking for employees. And so, yeah. So I'm hearing it's good. I'm hearing we're on the rebound, and that's a good thing because the economy sure took a hit during the last few years. And we'd love the snowbirds to come in here and spend their cash.
What kind of a financial package is City Manager Mike Ortega bringing to you and your colleagues this year?
It is good with an asterisk, and the good is that we were heavily subsidized through COVID by the federal dollars that came to not just us, but to all jurisdictions, the ARPA funds. The COVID dollars really kept our head above water. With that, we were able to keep people housed, you know, with the rent assistance and utility assistance and support for things like preschool and daycare to keep people the opportunity to go to work and not have to spend their, you know, there were a lot of people had their hours cut, not
sure.
Have to spend all their salary on childcare. So we along with the rest of the community significantly benefited from the federal dollars. Those are drying up, and so we're at the tail end of that. Now we're looking at tax revenues. The Our tax revenues are sufficient to meet our needs. One of the big challenges that we have, though, actually two of the big challenges. One is that the state legislature passed a flat tax, and that is going to cost us roughly $27 million annually.
Wow.
in general fund dollars. And so they, to ease the blow and to help jurisdictions kind of ease into that loss of revenue, they're making a one-time payment of $24 million. But we have to have that on our radar screen going down, looking down the field, because that flat tax is in place now at the state level, and it's going to be a continued significant hit to our general fund going forward. So that's one thing. And the second thing that we really have to keep our eye on is the notion of vacancies and the need to fill vacancies. I mentioned Arizona Inn is having a tough time filling. That's just by anecdotally. The city is also having a tough time filling vacancies. We've got something like 70 vacancies in our environmental services. We have, I think, 87 in the water department, roughly 100 for the police department. And it's not for lack of effort. I mean, we're out there offering a competitive wage package.
Yep, gotta go.
Yeah. Okay.
Sounds like there are lots of openings right now. Thank you, Steve Kasachek.
Thank you, Bill.
All right.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana. Plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show after our cold snap, which I would venture to say is probably the last freeze of the season. This is a perfect time of year to head over to Green Things and head over with confidence that the freezing weather is now officially behind us. 3384 East River Road for Green Things, 13-acre site. Chocked full of wonderful spring items, and their knowledgeable service staff, sales staff, will point you in the right direction. Not only point you in the right direction, they will take you and show you items that will do well for our spring and upcoming summer season with our characteristically very warm, hot temperatures that are on the way. Green Things, in their 53rd year of business, their sister business is Zocalo Village. Great merchandise, including beautiful Talavera pottery from Mexico. Websites, greenthingsaz.com, zocalovillage.com. When we do our telephone interviews, our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. But we will be doing an in-studio interview for the remainder of our program. And even though the weather has been uncharacteristically winter-like, it is spring and it is Easter week. Joining us in studio, our faith and spirituality contributor, Father Robert Hendrickson, Father Robert, rector at St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church, where my family worships. How are you, Father Robert?
I am well, and it's a joy to be here as always.
Well, the last time we saw you was the beginning of the Lenten season. How was your Lent? And many people think, well, there's still a couple of more days of Lent, but no, Lent actually ends tomorrow.
Yes, it ends on Maundy Thursday, sort of Holy Thursday of Holy Week. You know, the challenge is, you know, people want to run out and eat whatever it is that they didn't eat during Lent, but then you have Good Friday, which is another fast day.
And
then,
yeah.
So it's not, you're not all in the clear to eat all the chocolate yet.
Is this what's called the Triduum?
Yeah, the Triduum. So it's
Triduum.
Three, which
is that Latin?
It is Latin for three sacred days.
Okay.
Which is Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, and Holy Saturday and the Easter Vigil.
So how was your Lenten season personally?
Personally, it was good. I mean, I've been trying to maintain a certain level of discipline about food, which is, you know, as many of us do, and so COVID wasn't good for my diet, so it was a good time to get a little back under control.
Well, look at your diet. You look fantastic. You've lost 80 pounds, and I assume that wasn't that your commitment or your pledge for Lent was to go on a diet. You did not lose 80 pounds in 40 days or whatever.
No, it's been since November. But it was good to have Lent to sort of stick to it. But as I told somebody, I said, I'm starving myself to stay pretty, as they say.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Good Friday is the most sorrowful day. It's a sour day, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's a sad day, certainly, on the Christian calendar, commemorating Jesus' suffering, the crucifixion, and death. So why is it called Good Friday instead of, like, Bad Friday, Horrible Friday? I mean, what's good about this Friday?
I think you know, historically, the way we view it as good is that it sort of sets in motion what sort of Christians consider to be the decisive turn in human history, which is the resurrection. So you know, there was a hymn that I used to never get that called the there's a hymn, and it said, often sung at Christmas time, and one of the lines is about it's all the different joys of Mary, and they said one. Well, I forget which one it is. The sixth great joy that Mary had was to see her son on the cross, and I thought, oh my goodness, and it never quite made sense to me.
Yeah,
it's a medieval hymn, so you got to give him a little latitude.
Uh-huh.
But the idea being that all Christians sort of encounter this mystery of the cross with not only the kind of sense of sorrow that is embedded deeply within it, but also with a sense of anticipation that we know the end of the story, and this is the beginning of a new story about eternal life for those who believe.
But think about this, 72 hours going from utter sorrow to joy.
Absolutely. Well, and how many of us know, I mean, it's just past Sunday was Palm Sunday, where you begin with a big festal procession, and then you very quickly go to hearing the passion story read. And so the entire mood kind of changes almost immediately. And, you know, the spiritual sort of, equivalent that I kind of tried to draw out was when I was in, I think it was fourth grade, and all the kids in the school, in each of their classrooms, gathered around TV sets to watch the Challenger launch, because
yes,
that was when Christine McAuliffe was going up, and
yes,
there was a teacher. And
yeah.
And suddenly all these kids are watching in schools across the country, and there's this explosion. And so almost immediate shift from joy to just devastation. And that's certainly the experience of the disciples, but just as quickly the experience shifts in a whole other direction. And that's really the kind of the narrative arc of this week. And it's, you know, it's one that I think all of us experience in our lives. How many times do we give someone a kiss goodbye, not realizing it's the last one? How many times do we all have those times of spiritual kind of disjointedness or rupture in our lives, but they're all part of the long story of what it means to be human, in this case, what it means to be divine, as we watch this week unfold.
In preparation, and I do try to prepare for my guests, just like you prepare for all of your wonderful sermons that you deliver at St. Philip's, I came across a quote from Martin Luther. Our Lord has written the promise of resurrection, not in books alone, but in every leaf in springtime. So you have this promise of wonderful things to come, not only in the spring season, but with Easter and the Easter story.
Absolutely. And it's sort of, you know, I think that there's so much of the way we sort of frame human history, and really the history of the whole cosmos, is sort of intertwined with God's love, and God's love being expressed most fully in the resurrection. And so we do see within the sort of the rhythms of nature, and within so much in the world around us, that story unfolding in different ways. So you might see it sort of the analogy written out in the way in spring blooming. But you might also see it written out, you know, it's there's a reason that sort of Jesus goes into the desert and in Lent. And there's I think that our faith is sort of kind of a deeply physical one. It's sort of, we don't just sit around and sort of, you know, meditate privately on sort of holy things, but we engage the world around us and the people around us and nature and all of this, because, you know, the sight of all these miracles is this creation that God has made. And so it also tells its own story, and its own revelation happens day by day if we're paying attention.
Our Monday one-on-one this week was appropriate. We had the rabbi, Tom Lockheim. Tom, I've known Tom for many years here in town. He came in and enlightened me, and I hope our listeners, about the Passover story, and how the whole Passover story, as Easter, does have some similarities in about renewal is part of the Jewish Passover celebration.
Renewal, and I think recommitment to a covenant relationship with God. I mean, I think they. A demonstration, both in Passover and in the Easter miracle, of God's faithfulness to the people who follow, and so I think that to me is sort of what is embedded in this entire thing, that it is renewal, and I think part of the reason that the church, goes so deeply into this story in this week, is because it is our opportunity to recommit to it and to rediscover who we are as a people and why we are as a people. Sort of, why are we bound together in this way, and what is it? What is our hope together? And this is our opportunity to sort of live more fully into that as much as we can.
Was Easter a big deal for you growing up?
You know, it's funny. My family was not, they were devoutly Roman Catholic, but never went to church. And I'm sure we all have family members like that who are very religious, but not terribly churchy. So we did, so things at home. We would go to my grandparents' house and do sort of Easter egg hunts and things like that. But we church was not really part of my growing up. So
it was not part of your story, was it?
Not really. No, it was that's something that came later. Growing up, I was much more secular, for lack of a better word. Yeah.
Let's take a break right here. More with Father Robert Hendrickson, St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church Rector, Buckmaster, Midweek Edition, right after this quick break.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the Doubletree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. A lot of people are thinking about spring getaways. I don't blame them. I'm one of them. One nice place would be Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. It's only about a three-hour drive over to a beautiful area of the Land of Enchantment. Things are warming up rather nicely over in Silver City. Looks like they're going to be hitting, oh my goodness, low 80s. After the week, 73, then up to almost 80 degrees on Tuesday. So that is perfect weather to do some hiking in the Gila National Wilderness. Visit their website, southwestnewmexico.org. There you will be tempted by so many activities, many of them outdoors, and some great places to stay and dine as well in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. We have such a wonderful lineup of very loyal sponsors. I am so thankful for all of them. All right, we continue now with our conversation. It is Easter week. It is also today the beginning of Passover, and we kind of explored that on Monday here on our Monday one-on-one, but right now it's Father Robert Hendrickson, the rector at St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church. I see, Father Robert, that the latest polling that was done on church religious service attendance, and this is about what I would expect, and I'm probably not a big surprise to you, attendance was a bit down after the pandemic.
Yeah, we've had a kind of steady recovery, but I would say most churches are still down around a third. I mean, anywhere from a quarter to 40% seems to be the kind of standard range in terms of decreases in attendance before the pandemic. But there are all sorts of interesting things happening beneath the surface that are fascinating to us. So, for example, you know, the fastest growing sort of group we have are folks in their, you know, who are in their kind of early 30s to mid 40s, which has not traditionally been a sort of big, you know, last few years, at least everyone's talked about, well, we're all the young people. Well, for us, they're coming back in interesting ways. But the folks who have left, I mean, I feel like that the pandemic accelerated things that were already happening in our culture. So I think for some people who are kind of weren't sure where they were religiously, I think the pandemic sort of pushed them away from church. And I think for folks who are trying to figure out what to do with their family and trying to figure out how to be more connected in a community, I think the pandemic pushed them back into church and into community. So I think it's going to be decades before we actually really understand the full impact of this, not just on churches, but just on individuals and on our whole culture. I mean, it's kind of amazing. It feels to me like we're sitting in a very different place after the pandemic than we were before. But it also feels to me like an opportunity for churches to help people rediscover what it means to be part of church communities, what it means to have those kind of relationships they can depend on, and what it means to be held up by folks in the midst of their trials, which I think people were starving for during the pandemic.
The poll also indicated that the virtual experience kind of made up for those who stayed away during the pandemic, and it, in effect, became kind of a wash for attendance. The virtual service really did take off during the pandemic. Whether that stays, who knows?
Yeah, for us, it has become one more entry point for people into the church. And so it's become a way for folks to watch a sermon or kind of get a sense of what the church is like before they come. So we certainly do still have some folks who are only online, but that tends to be folks who weren't able to come to church at all before because of their mobility issues or things like that. So for us, it's become it has fit a pastoral need for people who have those kind of challenges, and it's become that kind of entry point and way of kind of validating the place before people show up and decide to come in person.
But the virtual experience, at least from my feeling, is just does not have the same feeling as the one-on-one or actually being in the presence of others.
Yeah, and you know, the way I sort of think about it is you know, you take what you're able to get, right? So if your choice was to not be able to go because you had, you know, extreme immune compromise in some sort of extreme way, if your choice is to not be able to do anything or to be able to participate online, then participating online is the thing you've got. Mm-hmm. But I think for most people, it probably doesn't satisfy that deeper need of being, you know, in direct companionship with people. And you know, we it's a faith where we bless bread and eat together, and where mm-hmm. we hug and we mm-hmm. engage one another sort of physically, and that physicality is really, I think, at the core of being in community, and that's very hard to sort of, you know, replicate. I mean, I liken it to the same way, you know, it's wonderful to talk to grandma on Zoom once a week, but it sure doesn't replace getting together for Thanksgiving, right?
No, right. You know what I mean? So you mentioned that the younger people, when you say the 30s and 40s, I guess would that be the millennials that are coming back, and maybe they have young families, and they're feeling like they are looking for some kind of a religious experience or faith experience.
Yeah, that's where we've seen a lot of our growth is among sort of younger families, and. The difference that I'm seeing now is before the pandemic, people would sort of come and they would sort of attend for maybe 6 months or a year before they really wanted to get involved. And right now people are showing up and the next day they want to be involved somehow or another, sort of serving in some way. And I think the pandemic really kind of inspired in people a desire to serve in some way or another, to kind of make a difference, to connect with other people. And so I think what we're seeing is folks who are coming back to the church are also sort of ready to serve and to connect in ways that maybe wasn't the same before the pandemic.
What about those that are looking at what you do, your profession, younger people deciding that they want to do the priesthood, that they want to serve full time, so to speak? I mean, what are those numbers looking like?
The numbers, I mean, there's a wave of retirees coming, sort of retirements coming.
Second career, third career type people?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of that right now. I mean, the challenge in many churches and in many parts of the country is that the kind of older model of having sort of one full-time clergy person for every parish, and in places like ours, multiple full-time clergy people, that is becoming harder and harder to sustain around mm-hmm. the country. And you know, it's just that if you go into any, you know, the similarities that I find are if you go into the downtowns of most rural towns anymore, that they're empty, right?
Yes.
And so they, in the same way they can't sustain a mom and pop store on every corner, they can't sustain a local church in the way they could before. And so that's one of the, you know, one of the things I caution people for about is as they sort of think about going into ministry, is to imagine all the ways that they can be in ministry that don't necessarily involve going right into seminary and trying to sort of serve in that sort of traditional model, but to be prepared to sort of do some creative thinking about how they can, you know, sustain a family and do all those sorts of things, and while at the same time living out the call that they feel. But it is I sort of jokingly told someone, I said, well, if you can imagine yourself learning to be the director of a steam engine, then perhaps, you know, that's about what it feels like. You know, sometimes being told you're being prepared to run a church, because it has a certain kind of, you know, antiquity to it that I think people sometimes find charming, but that also has its own challenges, right? I mean, it's sort of in a world that is increasingly secular, it's complicated to sort of explain to people what your role is, what your vocation is, in a way that they can both relate to, but it is also in a way that's invitational, where they feel sort of invited to sort of contemplate what it looks like for them to be involved in a community like you serve.
How about this Holy Week now, a message that you might have to our listeners?
I think I think the message that I would have is that, you know, all of this that we're going to participate in. So on Maundy Thursday, when the word Maundy comes from
tomorrow,
it comes from mandatum, sort of a command. Mm-hmm. The command is that you love one another. On Good Friday, we mark the story of the Passion and the Crucifixion, because it's a sign of God's love, however complicated that is. At the Easter Vigil, we celebrate, which is the Saturday evening service where we the first Mass of Easter, and we celebrate the gift of the resurrection given for the sake of God's love for the world. And so for me, this entire week really is about focusing in an intense way on the ongoing, ever-present love of God. And in a time where it feels harder and harder for us to get a sense of that love sometimes, this is a reminder that love is not just sort of present right now or in our communities, but is deeply embedded in the sort of DNA of creation, and is always there, even when we're not always sort of feeling aware of it. And this is a time when people can be reawakened to that love, and decide what that means for them. I mean, the best theological interpretation we can do is the way we live our lives. So this is the time for us to sort of recommit to that sense of love and how it's going to change our lives and the way we live.
All right, Father Robert Hendrickson, St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church. I hope it's a very meaningful Holy Week coming up for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and blessings to you and to your family and to all the listeners.
Hope everybody has a great afternoon. Thank you.